Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to Health Solutions, brought to you by Life Change Secrets and Barefoot Doctor. On this series we're exploring health and well-being in a changing world, looking at the very latest tools, tips and techniques and delving into what we can learn from the world's oldest healing traditions. My name is Sue O'Kell from Life Change Secrets and I'm delighted to be joined here today by Barefoot Doctor Stephen Russell and Coach Annie Kazina. Stephen will introduce Annie to you in just a moment, but for those of you not familiar with Barefoot Doctor, let me just say a few words about Stephen. You may know him as a musician, an author, broadcaster or columnist, or more lately from his online Barefoot Satsang or School for Warriors courses. He specialises in exploring, interpreting, practising and teaching the methods and philosophy of ancient Taoism, making these ancient Chinese teachings accessible and relevant for busy people in the modern world. Stephen's a Tai Chi master, an accomplished energy healer and a doctor of Chinese medicine. He ran a busy acupuncture healing clinic in London for 17 years before turning his attention to teaching, writing, broadcasting and making healing music. So welcome to the webinar, Stephen.
Thank you, Sue, and I'm very happy to be here with Annie Kazina today. Annie is no fool and no shrinking violet, yet she lived in an emotionally abusive relationship, making excuses for her husband for 20 years. She's educated in linguistics. She holds a PhD and has published two academic works in Italian. In her early career, she worked in teaching and outside catering before training in the Alexander Technique, NLP, and coaching. Annie now works as a women's empowerment coach and NLP master practitioner, drawing on her own experiences of recovery from emotional abuse to provide constructive help to other women who feel trapped in an emotionally abusive relationship. Annie works to help women reclaim their personal power, learn to value themselves, and to replace fear with faith in their abilities so that they can lead a happy, fulfilled life. The core of her work involves assisting people to communicate more effectively with themselves and the people around them, so that they create great relationships in every area of life. Annie is also author of several books, including The Woman You Want to Be and Say No with Confidence. Hello, Annie, and welcome.
Hello, Stephen.
What a lovely, rich voice.
Pardon?
Sorry, I cut you. I was going to say what a lovely, rich voice, and then I cut it off.
Thank you. You have a lovely voice, too.
Thank you. Annie, I want to start with getting a clear understanding of what's meant by emotional abuse. Can you tell us how you define that?
Well, I think emotional abuse is a term that is used to describe the things that people say and do that are actually designed to leave you feeling hurt and diminished. And it is something that is progressive. The damage done by emotional abuse builds over time. It's intended to chip away at the foundations of your well-being and self-worth. And in time, it will destroy you if you let it. And there is a purpose to emotional abuse. And that is, the purpose is to make the person abused feel small, fearful, defenseless, and needy. Because that makes the perpetrator feel powerful and in control. So what's really important is that emotional abuse doesn't just happen. It's not an accident. It's something that arises out of a clear intention. Whereas some people can sometimes say hurtful things, if they don't mean them, they will sincerely apologize and learn and express concern for the person they've hurt. An emotional abuser is someone who has a facility for saying and doing hurtful things intentionally. And when they say sorry, that apology is qualified. They'll say, well, if you hadn't done this, I wouldn't have done that, and time limited, which means they'll say, well, I did say sorry, but it wasn't really that bad.
Yeah.
The fault is yours because you're too sensitive. So it's a way of hurting people and actually playing with their perceptions of reality.
Yeah. Do you think that the people who perpetrate emotional abuse are actually cognitive of what they're doing, or is it somehow instinctual?
Well, it's something I've given a great deal of thought, and I think that they are reasonably cognitive, that they have a general awareness. They certainly don't mind having, they don't mind hurting other people, and their intention is to use whatever tools and weapons come to their mind, come to their hand, to create the result that they want. So, yeah, I feel it's conscious,
but
and that's a huge. For me, that was a huge thing to take on board. In my own life, I thought, he doesn't mean it. He's not doing it consciously. But the common thread is that it is a conscious. There is a conscious intention. The way they arrive at the different tools, that may be more or less reflex, but there is a conscious intention informing what abusers do.
And somehow it's compulsive. I get the impression it might be a compulsion in a way.
In a sense it is, because in a sense it is the only way that they know to discharge their feelings of anger and outrage, and in that way get their needs met. Their needs are met when they make their target feel very, very small and powerless.
Yeah. And do you work with just people who've had emotionally abusive husbands or partners, or do people come to you who've had abuse, say, from a parent, a sibling, or a work colleague?
People don't come to me on the whole because they've had abuse from, say, a work colleague, because if that's the only kind of abuse they've experienced, then upsetting as it may be, it's probably not agonizing. People come to me largely because of abuse in their intimate relationship, the pain in the now, but when I explore with them, there is usually the pain of an emotionally abused childhood behind them. It's a little like alcoholics. If you look at an alcoholic, behind that alcoholic, you'll probably see another alcoholic and another alcoholic going back in time. Abuse will carry on down the generations unless and until you do something to stop it. It is the abusive background that lays you open for abuse in the first place.
Yes. What really struck me about what you just said was agonizing, the word agonizing, because I guess it's agony, isn't it?
It is a tremendous agony, and there is no release from it. My situation at the moment is that I have been through a very, very difficult time because my partner's been very unwell. Mm. And that has been incredibly painful, but it's very different to the agony of an abusive relationship, because in an abusive relationship there is no light. It's like the tunnel will go on forever. There is no happiness, there is no meaning, and that is an agony that I think is without compare.
Is it somehow addictive for the victim, so to speak, the person who's being abused? Is there something addictive that makes it really difficult to get away from?
Yeah, that question makes me sigh, because it's a really complicated one. What the addiction, if you like, is a hopium addiction.
Yeah.
There is the addiction of hope. Most abusers will ensnare their partner by being as charming and engaging as they can be. It's a short-term possibility for them. They woo fast and they ensnare fast because that's all they're capable of before their negativity kicks in.
Yeah.
But what happens is they find someone, often who's got a huge, huge need of love and affection and has never really been made to feel that valuable in their own life. And they meet this person who, for a moment, will make a fuss of them and even put them on a pedestal and say all the right words. They parrot the words like love and marriage and togetherness and forever. And it feels great. So when the abuser starts to change, the partner goes, what's going on here? The man I love is kind and loving and gentle, and he makes me feel like I matter. So they see more and more of the anger and the fury and the hostility and all the negativity, and they go, but that's not the real man. The real man has so much potential. And if I can just help him, then we can get back to that potential. He can be the man I love. So it's a hokum addiction. And although I've said the woman, because I work a lot with women, that abusive relationship can be with the abuser of either sex. It doesn't have to be women being abused by men. It's common, but it's not always the case.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who's a lovely man, very strong, you know, real hero of a guy. He gets beaten up and has all his stuff thrown out of the apartment by his girlfriend approximately once every month, roughly. Well, I guess it would be, wouldn't it? But really, and then we have to go around and get him and bring all his stuff, and we keep saying, we know you're going to go back. And every month he goes back, and it's the same. You know, it happens on either side. I guess more and more now with the equalising of the sexes, there's potential for it. But talking about the abuser, a little bit more. Are there generally recognised reasons? I mean, why someone becomes an abuser? Presumably, they're not born that way.
No, they're not born that way. They probably witness abuse in their own home, and when they witness abuse, they may absolutely despise it. Mm. But a point comes when they grow up in their own life, if they don't do the work on themselves, where they will feel that a partner is taking advantage of them. And then they have this choice. Do they want to fall into the victim role or the abuser role? And the abuser role is, for quite a lot of people, more attractive, because at least it's a powerful role, and powerlessness is even more unpleasant.
Yeah.
But the point is that just because they've grown up with that model, it doesn't mean they have to fall into that.
Yeah.
It's the story they tell themselves about the world is still that old story, and you can change that.
So there is hope for the abuser as well, that they can be healed of it.
There is hope for the abuser if the abuser wants to heal. A lot of abusers don't want to heal because they don't need to heal. They can usually find someone else to visit their misery on, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You did touch on this before, but does the abuser effectively groom his victim, and are there the key signs to look out for?
Abusers always groom their victims. I liken it to cooking a lobster. I'm a cook, which is why I focus on the lobster. But one theory is that the humane way to kill your lobster is to pop it into a nice big pot of salted water and set it on a low heat. And the lobster will allegedly sort of just barely notice the heat rising until it's boiled to death. Most abusers will start out by going for small signs of compliance.
Mm-hmm.
They might say to you, we're going to spend the evening here, or if you're going to a restaurant, they might say, you've got to have the duck. Or in my own case, when I met my abusive partner, we were spending a day in a very, very cold February on a boat on the Thames. It was more like an orange box on the Thames. It's horrendous. But my future husband saw that I was wearing a little fur coat, which kept me warm, and he said, you can't wear that on the river. I said, oh, I can. He said, you can't, and took it off me. And that's compliance. The abuser will notice that he can override your decisions, that he can therefore start to make you his object. They look for what they can get away with, how they can overstep boundaries, push themselves. And they start gently, and they keep upping the ante. Occasionally, you get abusers who do it differently, like the people who drive a knife through between the eyes of a lobster to kill it. One woman I worked with told me that she was due to be meeting someone on a first date and he didn't turn up. So she phoned him and said, I don't expect people to do that to me. And he said to her, how dare you speak to me like that? I don't expect you to call me. She went out with him on a first date or second date, whatever you care to call it, and the stage had been set. He knew that he could treat her badly, and it just got worse and worse.
Yeah. Yep, go on.
So the key sign to look out for, the first one, is the message you get from your intuition, because every abused woman I've ever spoken to initially got a message that she didn't want to get, know this person. So you meet someone and they sort of look all right and they sound all right and your intuition says, no, you really don't want to do this. And most of us go, but what's the problem? This person looks fine. They don't have two heads. Because intuition doesn't tell you why you shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so we override intuition, find out to our cost that intuition was right. So intuition is a very important sign to look for. And as I just said, noticing that someone starts to take charge of you, take control of the situation, and impose their will on you in the small ways. Those are two very worrying signs. Another one is how an abuser behaves, how someone behaves to people who don't matter, like people in a service industry.
Yeah.
It's not important if they're nice to you and they're snarling at a waiter or waitress and have an anger issue with the other drivers on the road. That's a very bad sign.
Yeah. You were in that emotionally abusive relationship for 20 years. How long did it take for you to realize you were being abused?
20 years.
Really?
Yes. Around about 14 years, I began to realize that there was something very wrong in the relationship. But I'd married a second-generation Holocaust survivor who had a load of baggage, predictably enough. And marrying someone or involving yourself with someone who has a load of unresolved baggage is a pretty silly thing to do, as I learned to my cost. But because my husband had this mountain of baggage, I made excuses for him. Well, it's not his fault. He's had such a hard time, one thing and another. Actually, I'd had a fairly hard time too, and nobody was making excuses for me.
Yes.
But whenever I tried to say anything, he'd just tell me I was too sensitive, and I internalized all the blame and the guilt for the relationship. What finally changed was when I spoke to a psychotherapist who dealt with men with anger issues. And I had a 7-minute conversation with him during which he told me that my husband was abusive, emotionally abusive, that it was never going to change, and I might as well kick him out and change the locks. And once I had that diagnosis, once I had the label that I needed, everything started to fall into place, and then I could take the decision I needed to take. But it took 20 years.
But during that first 14 years, or you know, all that time, you must have been quite unhappy with him.
I was profoundly unhappy. I think I was as, you know, as unhappy as I had the capacity to be. I had a lot of suicidal thoughts. It was just dreadful. And that is how women in abusive relationships feel. That living in an abusive relationship absolutely saps your vitality and destroys your sense of self-worth.
But somehow, because you love the person, you don't even think about getting out of it or... Why do you stay in it for all that time if it's so horrible?
Well, you stay in it for a number of reasons. In part, you're brainwashed. An abuser will always tell you you're stupid and you're worthless and you're totally unlovable. Nobody else would ever put up with you, and you're incredibly lucky to have me.
Yeah.
And you end up believing that. There's also the fact that there is one agenda in an abusive relationship, and that is the abuser's agenda. So you've come to accept that you don't matter. Your only possible salvation in life is if you can make the abuser happy and if you can save the relationship. It's like going into a tunnel and your vision gets narrower and narrower and narrower, and it just focuses on the abuser. So you're left with that hopium addiction and this incredible sense of hopelessness and powerlessness.
So when you came out of it, your confidence and self-esteem must have been, were they really low at that point?
Rock bottom, yeah. Absolutely rock bottom.
And was it the Alexander technique and the NLP that saved you from that, that helped you build the confidence back up again?
Well, I always say to my Alexander teacher that she is a marriage breaker. There were actually several things that contributed to making me leave my marriage, but starting to get a different perspective, starting to see things differently through the NLP and experience myself differently through the Alexander technique created that window that allowed me to open up to a new possibility.
But once you were out and you were free of it, what kind of state were you in then? Did you have enough self-esteem and enough confidence to face life on your own and keep going? Was that difficult, that bit?
That was enormous, and that was not enormous just for me. From what I hear, it's enormous for everyone who leaves an abusive relationship.
Yep.
I think, unfortunately, there's very little understood about abuse in society, so that people think, well, they're out of it now. What's the big deal? Why don't they just pull themselves together and get on with it? But your confidence and self-esteem have been systematically dismantled. You've been programmed with negativity. You have a voice in your head that's still going, you're worthless, you're hopeless, nobody will ever want you, you're stupid, you can't do anything, you'll never manage on your own, which makes it very, very difficult. And you continue to live with the state of fear that you had before. An abuser turns your world into a very, very unsafe environment. And when you leave, you still think that you're living in that unsafe environment. So the abuser goes, but largely you continue to live with a nightmare until you take the time to change things.
How long did that take for you, from the time that you left him to the time that you actually felt stable and strong enough to, you know, that it felt all right being alive? How long did that take?
It's been an ongoing process. I think I started to realize that life had something to offer within a few months. And dismantling all of that stuff has taken years.
Yeah. But from the many hundreds of people that you've worked with, I wonder if emotional abuse morphs into physical illness too in some cases.
Well, I was married to a GP, and he would have hissed at me at a question like that, you've only got anecdotal evidence. And my guess is there isn't a lot of scientific evidence, but I have no doubt that it morphs into physical illness. How can it not? Since mind and body are connected, anything that affects your mind must affect your body too.
Yeah.
As an Alexander teacher, I know that to be true. And what happens ultimately is that your body will store, I believe, a great deal of pain to try and help you. It will store enormous amounts of pain and tension to enable your brain to keep functioning. But eventually, it reaches the point where it starts howling for attention.
Yeah.
And it howls through attention, for attention through pain and through functioning badly. I ended up with IBS, as a lot of women do. I count myself very, very lucky that that's the worst I got. I actually, come to think of it, I couldn't turn my head. I had dreadful, dreadful neck pain before I started the Alexander technique. That kind of thing's common. Back pain, all shoulder pain, any kind of pain, and I also suspect much more serious diseases come about as a result of years and years of emotional torture.
Yeah. Well, what about children? How do children cope when in the midst of an emotional abuse situation? Does the abuse spread to them? You did mention that earlier.
Yeah. Well, in my experience, the person who is abused is trying desperately to hold the home together, you know, because children need two parents, which is what we all say, but they do if they're two good parents. In the event the abused parent is desperately trying to protect the children from abuse, and they can't, children will sense what they don't see. But a lot of the time an abuser will actually perpetrate abuse in front of the children, because it's just part of the whole destructive syndrome. So children suffer horribly in abusive relationships. They suffer because they don't want to see the ugliness. They suffer because they have this vision of the world in which the stronger ride roughshod over the weaker, who get smashed to pieces. And that's a terrible, terrible heritage to grow up with. It impacts on them in many, many ways. It means they're likely to play out those roles in their own life, and it also means that they grow up with a huge amount of trauma that they probably can't even express for a lot of years.
Yeah.
And sometimes, sometimes you find that they will go into wildly self-destructive behaviors like drug addiction and promiscuity, and as a result, or they'll fail at school. They just struggle, and it's very hard for them to get the support they need.
Yeah. I was going to say, is it possible to lead a relatively normal life outside the home, or do people close to you notice that emotional abuse is taking place? Is it something that can go on in secret for a long time, in other words?
That's a very interesting one. The abused party does everything they can to make life normal and thinks they are being normal outside the home. That is, if they are allowed outside the home. Some people are. Some are so controlled by their partner that they're not allowed to have a job, they don't have access to their own money, and they are really kept prisoner in their own home and not allowed to associate with friends and family. Those who are on a somewhat looser rein can go out, earn money, and are relatively free to mix with people. But because you're keeping quiet about the destruction at the core of your life, you cannot really connect with anyone. So people may well notice that there's something strange about you. Your friends and family may notice that you've become distant. They may know that you're unhappy, but they cannot persuade you to do the sensible thing and leave the abuser, because that's the one option that you won't hear of. So,
what was it that got you to do it then? I know you said that, you know, that was there a moment that you saw the psychiatrist who explained that to you, that he was abusive?
Yeah.
Was it like immediately after that? Was there a point in time when you thought, right, that is it, I'm out of here?
Well, there was a point beforehand that led me to speak to the psychiatrist, and that was that my then husband took me away for a birthday. You know, it was one time in his life when he realized he had to pull out all the stops. So he took me away to an incredibly wonderful hotel, you know, five-star luxury hotel, leading hotel of the world. And there, he did what he'd always done. He stopped talking to me, and we had this beautiful junior suite, and he went off to sleep on the floor rather than sleep next to me and didn't speak to me for 2 days. And that he'd done that many, many times, and I'd always found it incredibly humiliating. And on this occasion, a voice in my head kicked in and said, look, this is a beautiful place. You're in one of the most beautiful cities in the world. Everyone here looks happy. We're healthy. We've got enough money to be here. Everything is great. And yet, he is making you incredibly miserable. This is his birthday gift to you. He's telling you that this will never change. And if you don't get out now, you will never have the strength to. You will die of misery in this relationship. That's what led me to contact the psychiatrist, and that's what propelled me out of the relationship.
Did he try and stop you leaving when you wanted to leave?
Well, he did the abusive man stuff. He realized that he'd gone too far. And so he started playing Mr. Nice Guy. Oops, terribly sorry, darling. Shouldn't have done that. Let's have a trial separation, and I'll be a good boy. And the plan was that if he moved out and was a good boy for a few weeks, then we'd go on dates, you know, play dates, and he would worm his way back into the house, and it would all disappear. So he had a strategy, but it didn't work this time. It had worked before, truth to tell.
Mm. You had extra strength this time, because you had the clarity, finally.
I had the fear. I honestly believed that I would die of misery, and fairly quickly, if I didn't get rid of him.
Yes.
And that's not being dramatic. It was just, I knew I was totally at the end of my strength this time.
Yeah. How old were you then? Do you mind me asking?
Yes.
All right, well, don't answer that then.
Far older than I should have been to realise that.
I know your husband wasn't violent, but I wonder if emotional abuse and domestic violence do tend to go hand in hand.
There's no doubt that they go hand in hand. People, the people who hit will use language as well. And unfortunately, we can get our head around the horror of physical violence. We don't get just how destructive emotional violence is. And it is violence. We have this idiotic statement that sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, if someone says something to you that's hurtful once or twice, probably not. But if someone who you love says something to you that's incredibly destructive in a moment when you thought you were safe and does that again and again and again, that will smash you to pieces. Yeah. And while I have not been on the receiving end of physical violence, and I've worked with many, many women who've been through horrendous, horrendous physical violence, they say that the thing that was most damaging in the long term was the emotional violence. It was the words,
yep,
not the blows. And I have to take their word for it.
You developed your own techniques as a result of your experiences. Can you tell me what in particular you felt was missing in terms of support for people who are in an abusive relationship and wanting to escape?
Well, what I found to be sorely missing is meeting the abuse sufferer where they are and honouring who they are. There's a lot of denial around abuse and domestic violence. People like to think it happens to stupid women on council estates at the other end of the country, that it doesn't happen to nice people like us. So when they hear that someone's been abused and beaten, they sort of put it at one remove by saying, well, this is stupid. Why did they tolerate it? And it's, you don't tolerate it because you're stupid. You tolerate it because you are unwisely, overgenerously loving. And you lose the sense of who you are in the process. So it's really important when you're working with someone who's been through abuse to make that person understand that what they've been through and how they feel about themselves is not who they are. It's tremendously important to give them this sense that they are not being judged. They are being met and honored as whole human beings, and their fears and their negativity can be taken on board, and they can be turned around, and turned around quite quickly. And that's what I find is missing. They'll be labeled. I've heard of women who've been told they're addicted to their abuser, as if that is useful. And if you can't work with them through that addiction, it's not useful to put a label on them. Yeah. And I've known of quite a lot of therapists who will wash their hands of women who've been through abuse. And again, that conveys a terrible message. It's so important to convey the message that not only can they heal, but they can be whole and far richer people than they were before once they incorporate all the learnings and all the experiences into the person they truly are.
Would you say that was the value of the Alexander technique, in that it gives you that sense of that your core self, beyond the personality, beyond the local, you know, the behavioural patterns, etc., that gives you that true sense of who you really are? Would you say that was an important tool that you had?
I hadn't quite thought of it in that way, but I certainly agree with it. I often use the Alexander technique as a metaphor that whatever happens to us, however mangled our bodies are and however twisted and out of shape they get, the Alexander technique can help you to function well and change your body set, because really using your body well has been hardwired into you. You know, like babies aren't taught to stand up and walk. That's been hardwired into them. They're quite graceful, really, and that's been hardwired into them. And by the same process, I honestly believe that happiness has been hardwired into every one of us. Yeah. Life gets in the way, but we can undo that hurtful, negative programming of life and get back to that native happiness. Mm.
Yeah, when you touched on this before, but after you left, how long did it take you to feel ready to start dating again? And how was that experience? Was it scary or exciting or both?
Well, I chose to take a long time before I tipped my toe back in the dating waters, and I did that for a very good reason. As everyone who's been through an abusive relationship will discover for themselves, when you first come out of an abusive relationship, you might as well have a big V for victim on your forehead. Mm-hmm. You still behave and react in the fearful ways you did before. And abusers will come out of the woodwork for a sort of 100-mile radius. It's like they smell the pheromones and they beat a path to your door. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly serious. That does happen.
Yeah.
And also, you feel, oh, God, I'm so worthless. This person has interested me. I'm so grateful. Oh, this person must be wonderful to be interested in little old me, which is a disastrous place from which to try and build a happy, successful relationship.
Yeah.
So I wanted to undo my abused programming before I started dating, because I did not want to be exposed to those same risks again.
Is it NLP that you use for that?
I used a whole load of things. I used NLP, I used EFT, I started creating some thoroughly unorthodox but effective techniques of my own, and I did a lot of work on thinking what I wanted out of a relationship this time and mm-hmm. what I wanted in a partner. Mm. And dating,
yeah, that's big.
It is very, very big, and it's very necessary. And sort of the reason for that was that when I first became a dog owner, I fell in love with a dog who was very cute and entertaining, and took this dog home, and it turned out that he was a prima donna who was sexually obsessed, never learnt house training, shattered all my nights with his bad behavior, and eventually I had to rehome him. Now, I learned from that. Before I bought my next dog, I did a huge amount of research to find the breed that would be perfect for me and the life I lived. And one day I sat down and said, what is going on here? I can research my holidays, I researched my dog and came up with exactly the right dog for me. How come I was prepared to accept whatever man came along? And why on earth would I do that in the future?
Can I ask you a question? When do you think that in the abusive relationship, which in a way, I mean, is a sort of form of sadomasochism, is that a sexual stimulant in itself? Does that make for good sex? Not necessarily, I'm not talking about lovemaking, but does it make for good sex?
I think the short answer is no. I've had a few clients who have told me that the sex is incredible, although when they've told me a little more, it sounded like the sex was pretty foul. But these relationships are about power and control. So yes. The sex. So abusers will do two things. They will demand sex, and they will quite frequently demand sex at the most awkward and unpleasant times.
Yeah.
So they will have a huge fight with you, not apologize, and then say, do you fancy a shag?
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem very sophisticated to me. Or they will say, or they will withhold sex. So they are using sex as a weapon. Mm. Very few women actually enjoy that in the long term.
Could I ask you about specific tips and techniques now? Let's say someone is in a relationship and they're debating whether to stay or go. Do you have some advice on how best to make that decision?
Well, I think the fact that they're already wondering whether they should stay or go suggests that there are problems. And I would like to know what their internal dialogue is, because if it's, oh God, what will happen to me if I leave? Will I ever find anybody else? That's a worry. That's not helpful. There are better questions. They should find better questions to ask themselves, like, what grounds do I have to think this relationship will ever get any better? Does this relationship make me happy? Will it ever make me happy? Is my partner prepared to take responsibility for his actions or her actions? How much more misery and emptiness can I take? And another great question. If I believed that I could have a truly happy life, maybe find love, but certainly be surrounded by people who truly care about me, would I stay?
Yeah.
So you need to start asking yourself new questions, otherwise you just go around the same old loop again. And the other thing is to get help and get support. Because if you keep asking yourself questions without arriving at a useful answer, you're obviously stuck on one track. You need someone who specializes in helping people in your situation to get a new and more helpful perspective on things.
As opposed to friends who aren't necessarily trained or qualified in helping with those situations, or as well as?
Well, unfortunately, friends may have their own agenda.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that if you're listening to a friend, you may well discount what they say if it's not what you want to hear anyway.
Yes. That's true. I'm I'm aware that people in abusive relationships become expert people pleasers. What's your advice on breaking out of that mindset?
That is a tough one. And in order to do that, you need to access the power of the mind and the unconscious mind. And what I love about the unconscious mind is that it can learn big lessons from small experiences. That's what we do all the time. We generalize from the particular. So we have one experience and we learn, this is the way it is. So you can't turn around from one day to the next and stop being a people pleaser. But what you can do is start giving yourself tiny, safe experiences of doing something different. And safety is a key concept. So what I say to women is you have to get an experience of the power of saying no. You can't do it with an abusive partner because you could get your head kicked in, or you'll certainly get a fight on your hand, which you don't need. No. So you find someone who you know is safe, someone you love and trust, and someone who loves and trusts you. It could be a family member, it could be a child, it could be a close friend. And you wait until they say, could you do something small for me? You know, like, would you mind getting me a cup of tea? Or could you just, and it really is something small, and you just say no. And it's really, really frightening even to say no to that small thing like, Mum, could you just iron the shirt for me before I go out? And you just say, no, I couldn't actually. No excuses, no justifications, no is a full sentence. And that can be hugely, hugely challenging if you haven't done it, if you're a committed people pleaser. But once you stay the first few small, safe no's with someone who'll say, oh, okay, I'll do it myself, or okay, then your unconscious mind starts to realize that it's safe to say no, and it also starts to realize that other people's reaction is their reaction. It doesn't mean that you don't have the right to say no. And that small no will be the beginning of the whole process of washing your hands of people pleasing.
Yeah. Improving your self-esteem and confidence could involve months, if not years, of work. But if you could give three top tips, three things that help people start to address these issues, what might they be?
Well, I'd like to say that it can take months or years, but there is the plus side as well, and that's that I find a lot of the people I work with are so hungry for happiness that they can make massive, massive leaps in an amazingly short time, and I really take my hat off to them because it took me a lot longer. But I think the three tips would be, don't feel you have to own all your thoughts. Trust your intuition, but question your thoughts. When you find yourself thinking, I'll never find a man, or I'll never be happier, or I'll never manage, question your thoughts. Ask yourself, how do you know you'll never? How do you know you'll always be unhappy, or you'll always be this, or always be that? You don't know. Question your thoughts. They may be telling you stories. And the second tip is change the Teflon coating. People pleasers, people who've been through abusive relationships, people with low self-worth, have this kind of Teflon coating. They believe they're worthless. Now, what actually happens is that while their partner, or someone very close to them, says negative things to them, there'll be other people out there who really appreciate them. But they've learned not to listen. So you can throw a load of good stuff at them, and it just seems to slide off the Teflon coating without ever landing. And it leaves the Teflon coating squeaky clean, so it's as if they hadn't heard it. So it's about changing that, starting to consciously say, I heard something good about me then, I'm going to take it on board. and you change the Teflon coating to letting the bad things slide off you.
That's good.
The third tip would have to be commit to working through a program that can help you. You have to understand that you're important to the people around you. You matter. And if you matter, you have to matter to yourself enough to commit to taking at least 10 minutes a day to treating yourself like you matter. And that doesn't mean the massage or the facial or the new cosmetics or going to the gym. It means focusing lovingly and constructively on healing your hurts for 10 minutes a day. That's really all you may need.
What's your advice for someone who has broken free and wants to start dating again? Are there specific things they need to be aware of?
Well, I would start by paraphrasing Tony Blair. Intuition, intuition, intuition. You really have to listen to your intuition all the time. You have to get out of the I'm a needy person stuck in the last chance saloon mindset and start paying very clear attention to prospective partners. One of the things I do is teach people the art of online dating, about how to read people's profiles correctly and screen thoughtfully. Having a pulse and dressing reasonably well and not looking like Frankenstein are not reasons for having a relationship with someone. You have to create the profile of your ideal partner, which I mentioned before. And it's not about externals. It's about how you want to feel around this person, how you want to relate with this person, how you'll know that this person is kind and caring, how they'll treat you, how you want a life with this person to pan out. Exactly what you want in an ideal partner. That will really, really help you to be much clearer. And when you're clearer, you'll be less likely to settle for anything that comes along with a pulse.
Mm. Well, in the system that I use myself, when you're being victimized by somebody, when you're being abused by somebody, at the deepest level, it's indicative of how unconsciously you're abusing yourself, primarily. And do you hold anything with that?
I always have a slight reservation around that one, because people are always blamed for being abused, or society is too quick to blame people for being abused. People swallow the abuse because then they never know, they've never been taught that they are allowed to do anything different. It's a bit like if nobody ever taught you to watch out for cars when you're crossing the road,
yeah,
you would probably very quickly get hit by a car. You've not been taught how to stand up for yourself, how to honor yourself, how to keep yourself safe from abuse. You've been taught actually how to be abused. Therefore, that is what you're programmed to do. That is how your thermostat's been set until you change it.
So would you say that then, if you had recognized that there was something in that, that they were mirroring something that was going on unconsciously within, and then you healed that by learning to love yourself and forgive yourself and accept yourself as being the beautiful, radiant being that you are, would that be the key to releasing you from the abusive relationship in a way? Is that possible?
I think that's a really difficult one. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that you could be in that relationship and change yourself.
Yeah, and then by doing that, that's what would be the key to liberation that would set you free, or might even get the other person to start behaving differently.
I think that, I mean, yes, that is the ideal possibility. In the real world, I think that is too hard for most people who have been so physically and emotionally drained by the relationship.
Yes.
And sure, you've got to do that work for yourself, but is it really worth, pardon me, making that bit harder? by trying to do that and be in the relationship and have that constant grind going on at you at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. So practically it's probably not realistic.
I think it makes it incredibly hard, and when people have been through so much difficulty already, it's like putting a huge rucksack on their back and saying, could you run up the mountain now, please?
Yeah.
It's probably just too much to ask. It would have been for me, that's all I can say.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as we mentioned, you're now very happy in your relationship. I'd imagine that that's not necessarily the case for women who maybe escape their relationship, their abusive relationship, but don't have help and advice to overcome their issues. Why is support so crucial, would you say?
Because if you don't have the help and support, the chances are you will be attracted to the same kind of man again, or something that looks quite the opposite but is the same.
Yeah.
And you will fall back into the same patterns, because we automatically repeat patterns until we bring what we're doing up to the conscious level. We operate in a default way. So you will be bound to carry on suffering with that same old programming, agonizing over those same beliefs about yourself. They don't just fade away because you're not in the abusive relationship anymore. They Yeah. continue to blight the present.
And what's your opinion of the professional support that's out there in the psychiatric and mental health services?
Well, I'd love to say that it's fantastic, but unfortunately my experience has been that it's largely sorely inadequate. As I've said, there's a lot of ignorance about the true nature of abuse, and there's a lot of the pull yourself together and get on with it attitude and pointing the finger of judgment at the victim. So I end up working with a lot of women who've been and seen counsellors and therapists who may have talked to them about the abuse but they haven't actually moved them on.
Yeah.
Because they haven't understood that these women need to find something, these people need to find their own resources within themselves. They need to be shown their strengths. They need to be shown what's valuable about them. They need to understand what's happened to them and that what's happened to them is not who they are. And on the whole, that's not happening. There is this lack of comprehension and lack of empathy, which really doesn't help.
Yeah. So tell me about the different kinds of support that you now offer, Annie.
Well, these days I offer a number of different levels of support. There are my e-books. I've got The Woman You Want to Be for women who are happy to work through a specifically designed program that will guide them along their recovery journey for a whole year. There's Married to Mr. Nasty, which will tell them all about why he behaved the way he did and how that affected them. I've got a couple of audio programs. There is Healing the Seven Wounds, which is all about healing the seven wounds all abused women suffer from. And those seven wounds are not believing in yourself, not trusting your perceptions, not feeling lovable, self-sacrifice, the wound of invisibility, the wound of not being your adult self, and the wound of shame. There's a new program whose title is self-explanatory, and that is How to Stop Loving a Jerk. And there are teleclasses. Some I run on specific topics, and there is the ongoing Reclaim Your Life teleclass program, which is all about helping people to understand how emotional abuse impacted on them and how they can rise from the ashes stronger, better, and more beautiful spiritually and emotionally from all they've been through. And these are live interactive calls that take place twice a month. And then there's my VIP one-to-one coaching program for people who want that extra access, so we can spend time, all the time that they need, working through their specific situation and issues, so they can turn their lives around in as short as possible time, with the maximum support from me. So those are the programs I'm offering.
It's really comprehensive. I think listening to this chat, a lot of people, I'm hoping, I'm sure, a lot of people who are in abusive relationships or know people who are, will find it extraordinarily helpful. And I'm really grateful to you for being so open and candid and willing to talk about it. Where can people find out more about your books and courses?
They can find out from going to my website, which is www.recoverfromemotionalabuse.com.
Annie Cassini, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.